Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. We talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. We are glad that you joined us today. And I want to mention that this fine community radio station just celebrated its 10th birthday this last weekend. We had a fine gathering. We had cupcakes. We had a little bit of a shower, but we also had a rainbow, and we had good music. Thanks to all the people that showed up, and thank you for all of you who support KHOI Community Radio. Well, today on the Donalana Kitchen, we're going to explore our sense of taste. We've been kind of diving into the pantry lately.
This is our pantry series. This is the second show in the pantry series, and there'll be one more after this.
So tasting things, and especially tasting herbs and spices, there's some always new surprises out there, and I recently had a surprise. Joining us here at the kitchen table is Ben Hawks. Hello, Ben.
Hey, how we going?
Good. Ben is a naturalist, a forager, a prairie enthusiast, and he often brings me things to taste that he has found, that he forages. And I've learned to trust him. And so when he says, here, taste this, I did. And Ben, what in the world was that you gave me to taste? It was like something on my tongue. What was that?
Gosh, well, that plant is called prickly ash. So it's spelled the same way as an ash tree, but it's not related to our ash trees. What makes this unique is that it's a small shrub. It kind of grows on the edges of forests and thickets. It likes a little bit of sun and a little bit of shade. And it is actually in the citrus family. It is the Midwest's member of the citrus family. So we're talking oranges and lemons and that whole thing. This shrub, its genus, it's kind of a tongue twister in the way that it also makes your tongue kind of twist up. It's Xanthoxylum, kind of a fun thing to say. But this is a longtime resident of Iowa. It's been here since, you know, the glaciers left. And this shrub has some really cool properties. It's been used by native people for a long time for a variety of uses. And we learned about it from them. All parts of the plant contain these alkaloids, these plant chemicals that they use for defense. And like a lot of plants you'll be talking about today, plant defenses, whenever we taste them as humans, we go, well, those taste really good, or those taste really unique. Like, for example, the spicy capsaicin from peppers, or the really strong flavors of mint that come. Those are to keep animals away from eating them. But because humans, you know, so prickly ash, you can use all different parts of the plant. You can harvest the fruits, and you can harvest the bark. So I first learned about this plant when I was living in Wisconsin. There's a fella called Kenny Solway, and Kenny is known as that talk about how he's used and lived along the river to make his life more rich. When he was a kid, he used to harvest the bark of prickly ash and sell it for 10 cents a pound. And that it was used in a way to cure toothaches. And that's how it earned the name toothache tree
plant. Yeah.
Harvest. What I usually look for are the fruits. Yeah, not to be confused with that herb that's grown in the garden that has the little yellow flowers. This is completely different than that one. It's a different family altogether, probably some similar compounds. But I usually seek out the seed capsules. So when this plant makes a seed, it's hard and black, but there's a little capsule on the outside that holds this seed. And when the seeds drop, you can harvest these capsules and you can use them as a spice. Now, these are really unique. Like, all you need is just a tiny little amount. It's a blast of citrus right on the front half. And then on the back end, it actually makes your tongue numb and cold in a similar way that mint does. But also, like, if you've ever tasted echinacea root, it has like a medicinal taste to it. You know, you'd have a sample of that and go, oh, I don't think I want to be eating a tablespoon of that. But in small amounts, it could be quite interesting to add to meals.
It also, the longer you have it on your tongue, like 5 minutes later, the numbing sensation is quite pronounced. It is related to Sichuan peppers, right, Ben?
Yes, it is in the same, it is a relative. It's in the same genus as the Asian species, yes.
Pretty amazing thing to taste, because I was tasting it 10 minutes later, and not a bad taste, just really interesting.
So I talked with some chefs in the Des Moines area about using it, and I think it would be really good ground up and just use as a light dusting on just about anything. But one of the chefs I talked to, he paired a very small amount of it with like some fresh chilled melon. And to have that like cold, sweet, you know, like cantaloupe flavor with a little bit of a zing to it, he said it really makes both of them pop. I have been going through this concoction of like oil and chili peppers. As I've been harvesting this local plant, I come to realize the taste that I'm picking up in there is in the ingredients. And it actually used to be illegal to import to the United States because they are going to bring diseases over to our North American crops. So I think folks had to get creative. If they were going to ship it over, they had to hide it in other things. Mixed up in some chili paste already, and you didn't list it in the ingredients, you could probably sneak it past customs.
I actually hand-carried some back
so,
from China.
It's a unique plant. And so another interesting thing about it is that the fruit, it very rarely sets fruit. So it's hard to get seed capsules collected for spices. It seems like every 10 years it makes a mast. Like this year is a really great year for acorns and butternuts crops. In the same way, this plant takes advantage of different cycles and does things we don't understand. And in certain years, the plants are covered. And this year, the plants are quite covered with it. I was able to harvest a gallon or more of.
No, it's really fun. It's a, let's call it a good party trick. You know, you get somebody to eat this stuff and they're chomping along. And all of a sudden, not only are they getting flavor, which is a nice heat, a very round heat. There's more than heat to it. But then it starts doing this numbing thing on your tongue, which is. For people who have never had it, it's a little like, whoa!
Yeah. Well, good. Thank you. Thank you. And thank you for the taste of that prickly ash stuff. It is pretty neat, I must say. And I'm going to try to learn how to try it on some different things. Thank you for joining us today, Ben.
No worries.
So there are a lot of other local herbs and spices that over the years Lana and I have talked. Well, first we want to, Lana, talk about the difference between herbs and spices.
Well, as I understand it, herb is the leaf
exactly.
of a plant. And the spices tend to be the hard parts. Now that,
yeah, the
that
barks, can, the seeds. Bark,
yeah,
the,
see, huh? So, uh-huh. Yeah, and but they all improve our lives.
Well, and we do grow a lot of things. You know, Lana and I are all about seasonal and local, and we're coming into the end of the local herb season. And so we will be preserving a lot of things. We dry our own basils, dry. I'm going to do a thing with my thyme this year, doing salt, mm-hmm. putting it in mm-hmm. salt. And what else am I saving? Oh, I did some shiso vinegar, some tarragon vinegar. Lana does lots and lots of drying. So,
yeah, I like to dry things that I can turn into tea mixes, I make some herb tea. I can grow a lot of different mints, a lot of different basils, especially the Tulsi basil, the holy basil, which as a culinary basil, not so good, but as a tea, it's really fine.
It's medicinal. Like the prickly, what's it called that he just did? Prickly ash, for example, is an old-time remedy for arthritis, right?
Yeah.
Arthritis. It'll fix up your arthritis, right? So it's an anti-inflammatory among many other things, which is why it was also used for toothaches. So a lot of herbs and spices have medicinal qualities. A new thing that I'm going to try this year, because Lana and I both grow lemon verbena and rose geranium. This might also work for anise hyssop too. These herbs that I use the leaves for, mostly for sweet dishes. I'm going to try grinding the leaves in the food processor with sugar and then freezing it to see if I can still have that fresh herb flavor all year long. So we're always fooling around with our local herbs and spices. But for centuries and eons, I'm sure you were all taught this in history class, the spice trade, was the beginning of the global food supply. And it is, you know, thousands of years old. This goes back to AD when, you know, little boats were sailing from Southeast Asia over to India and et cetera. And the spice trades, the things that we were trading thousands of years ago are things that we still eat. Cinnamon, cardamom, ginger, pepper, nutmeg, star anise, clove, turmeric, and a lot of peppercorns, different kinds of peppercorns. And then, of course, there's salt. The salt trade was also a global, you know, a global thing. And so a lot of these spice trades were things that were only grown in tropical climates. So, of course, the Europeans loved having that sort of thing. So one of the things that we keep in our pantry, one of the most important things, are the different kinds of spices. And I'm gonna do a trick on Lana today. I have some new spices that I had ordered from Burlap and Barrel. I like ordering from Burlap and Barrel because they source directly from the farmer. So it is a fair trade organization. And they are kind of, it goes directly from the farmer to them to the consumer. It says on their website, it says the spice trade has historically been exploitive and extractive, focused on quantity over quality, which with no thought for the well-being of the farmers. The result is that the only spices available to cooks in the U.S. have passed through an unnecessarily complicated network of intermediaries where quality goes down and prices go up with each handoff. So Burlap and Barrel treats the farmers as partners and they buy directly from them. They also encourage them to do processing on farm, like their own drying or their own, you know, because each spice has a different kind of thing. So I have some new things that I'm going to have Lana taste. This might be the most subtle one, Lana.
Oh dear, subtle.
Yeah.
Okay. Tasting this stuff.
Tell me what you think this one is. This one you don't usually think of as buying in a dried powdered form.
I have no idea.
She's speechless. It's called drumstick lemongrass. It's a powdered lemongrass.
You wouldn't think.
I know it's. I mean, when I tasted it, I thought, oh, I don't need to just use this on Asian things. It's called chicken leg lemongrass is named after the shape of the plant, which tapers from a wide base like a chicken leg. Grown by a collective of Hmong farmers in the mountains of northern Vietnam, this lemongrass powder is gently dried and ground into powder for maximum surface area and convenience. Add a little bit to marinade, soups, stews, stir-fry, sweets. It has a citrus perfume.
Yeah, it does. So, it does. And it's this white, dusty stuff.
Yeah.
But lemongrass is not something that one. Although I think you can grow it seasonally in a greenhouse here in the Midwest. It's not really your sort of local.
No, but this powdered form is, it gave me a new insight into lemongrass that I'm going to be exploiting. You'll probably hear more about it. Okay, now here's the next one, Lonnie. You may know this one.
As opposed to the last one, this is a dark black dusty looking stuff. Oh, I have tasted this before. This is the black lime. It tastes like lime, but it tastes like gutsy lime.
Yeah.
And does black lime mean it's like roasted?
It's a very interesting process. It actually is a Persian kind of dried lime thing that
That's
you
good.
Can buy the whole thing, this dried up lime looking thing, and you grate it. And so the burlap and barrel brings
good
it
stuff.
In already grated. So it's really useful in all kinds of Mediterranean foods and also in more Mexican things where you just want that lime flavor. This comes from Guatemala, and the process is the Guatemalan farmer grows the limes, then they soak them in water for a long time, and then they dry them in the sun. So it's a, you know, and this particular black lime is, of course, a single source from the Alta Verapaz in Guatemala with a particular farmer, and he does his own on-farm processing. Okay, now.
Yum. Okay, oh,
here comes it.
This is sort of a blind taste test here.
Right. Well,
so,
is a good
I hope
to do this.
All right.
This
all
one
right.
Is a little strong, so I'm going to try to go easy.
Thank you. Okay. Oh.
It's kind of orangish in color.
It's orangish?
Mm-hmm. And it's very strong.
Oh, my. Wild.
They call it wild hing.
Now, how am I ever supposed to guess this wild hing?
Okay.
I don't know wild hing
what it
is
asafoetida.
Oh!
Which is a really unusual, it's mostly associated with Indian food. Now, they mix it with turmeric because it is so strong. And even when I was sent this package, she said, use a tiny, tiny little bit. She said, eighth of a teaspoon. I am not kidding. She said,
"Oh,
it's so strong." So asafoetida, which say that 10 times. Let that roll off your tongue.
Asafoetida
is used particularly. There are Indian people in India who, for religious reasons, do not eat garlic or onions. Now, try imagine cooking curry without garlic or onions. Well, this is where the asafoetida comes in.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it can be a lovely ingredient in curry, among other things.
Lovely.
It's a very, very strong flavor.
Oh. Yeah, see, I've run across that name before, besides not being able to pronounce it. Yes, it is a strong thing, and I wondered, what in the world does one use it? So, okay.
Okay, now, I'm just giving her samples of things that are actually right on the Burlap and Barrel website, so... because when I go and read it, and then I makes you want to taste these things. So, you know, it's hard to describe like we do on the radio. It's hard to describe a flavor. So when you have the real live thing, this is
a dried pepper.
Dried? It's a dried kimchi. It's like
numb.
Yeah. I'd never even thought of this, but they just, like, kind of dried the kimchi, dehydrated the kimchi, and it makes a really lovely sprinkle on all kinds of
things.
Who'd
have thought? Okay. Who'd have thought?
All right.
It looks sort of like dried pepper. I mean,
yeah,
well,
it kind of does,
course.
But it definitely has pepper. Okay, this is the last one. This is a sort of mystery one.
Oh, great. I've been doing really good here.
Yeah, right. All right, you might get this one. I'll say it has salt in it, okay? That part will be obvious. I'm giving it to her in a little piece of bread and butter.
It's crunchy. It's lumpy.
That's the salt.
I'm no good at this.
Oh.
What is this?
Okay. It is balsam fir salt from upstate New York.
Now that is a good idea.
Yeah, in the early spring.
I seldom eat trees, but this is good.
I know. It says, in the early spring, balsam fir evergreens put out the new growth needles, which are sweet and aromatic for only a few weeks before they darken and turn fibrous and bitter. Our balsam fir needles were handpicked, dried, and ground before being blended with there's a salt deposit in upstate New York, so it's made there. This seasoning, this seasonal finishing salt is bright, herbal, and resinous, perfect for garnishing sweet and earthy vegetables, game meats, and fresh seafood.
This is a salt that leaves
tastes
you
like
that leaves you this
tastes like a Christmas tree.
Well, yeah. But see, there's so many surprises and there's so many good things we can taste. That's wonderful.
Yeah, they also have I'm gonna tell you what this one is so you can taste it. This one I find really, really hard to find. This is it's related to thyme. People use it as a substitute for thyme, but it is flowering hyssop thyme, which is, it's a very special herb only grown in the Middle East, mainly Palestine. Ancient history of culinary and medicinal use and has beautiful floral herbaceous flavor. Use it in place of regular thyme. This one is sourced from Palestine and it's
very aromatic.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm through eating it and trying to figure out what the heck that was. Mm-hmm. But actually in the aftertaste and the aroma, I can still smell it.
Yeah.
It's still in my head.
Yeah.
Isn't that wonderful? My
goodness. So, for example, if you're using a lot of Ottolenghi cookbooks, he uses a lot of Middle Eastern flavors. And actually one of his books, I think it was the Flavor book, came out the same year. It's called Flavor. The same year I found Burlap and Barrel. It's not a very old company, and we have talked about them before. But in the book, he used a lot of this this black lime. And so I was like, oh, I can just order this. So these are things I keep in my pantry because, sometimes you just want to throw the chicken in the oven with a little onion and garlic, and then you want something special on it. So you can sprinkle some sumac powder, for example, which is it's actually some of the sumac that we have here is sumac. I have a sumac tree in my yard. Now there is poison sumac, so you want to be careful, but I think that the red sumac is the same sumac. I'm not going to promise you this, don't go eating it without somebody.
Order the sumac from.
Yeah,
from,
right.
A really bad rash.
You can order it from numerous places that have Middle Eastern spices, but I have ordered it from Burlap and Barrel. Their sumac is really, really nice and bitter.
Oh, this is
sour.
So we started out with Ben talking about prickly ash, and we've gone through all kinds of stuff, and we will come right back and talk more about things that are in our pantry since we're kind of stocking up for the fall as the garden comes in. It's nice to know there's good stuff out there. You're listening to KHOI. This is Donalana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa.
Thank you.
we're back. This is the Donald on the Kitchen. We're talking about tasting things. Tasting is very, it's a very personal sort of thing, but because we cook for other people, it's nice to be able to share the joy of things here. And Donna's been talking about a company she really likes to order things from. You could probably find these things other places, but these tastes are worth exploring. And Donna, here, you know, I don't even taste this one. It's already in my nose. She opened the jar, and what have we here, Donna?
Oh, this is really strong.
I think you overdid that one.
This is a smoked star anise. Now, let me say there are, you know, wherever your favorite source of buying herbs are, and there are some good ones, like we have Frontier Natural Herbs also, that's an Iowa company. You want to try to find things that, I mean, one of the reasons I buy so much from Burlap and Barrel is because their herbs and spices really are fresh, which means more flavor. The shorter the distance between you and that farmer on the other side of the world, the less time in the processing, the more flavor you're going to get, because these herbs and spices carry volatile oils, and those do evaporate over time, which is why it's really good to refresh. The average time that a spice should sit in your shelf is maybe 6 months, unless it's like we're tasting the star anise. This is a whole, it's the whole flowering pod. Now, once you break that star anise up by grinding it, you will release the volatile oil. So a already ground star anise powder will lose its potency more quickly than the whole thing.
Right. And anise, what, is that a flower? No, it's a pod.
It's some kind of seed pod-y thing.
It looks like a little hard flower that is about, oh, the size, a little smaller than a quarter, maybe no more about the size of a nickel. But they vary in size.
And yeah, and they have like pretty, seven-point star.
Seven-point star. It's a beautiful thing. And you hear them, see them referred to in recipes for the holidays. It has that holiday.
Or Chinese five-spice powder often has star anise in it. So you can make your own Chinese five-spice powder and have it much more fresh, vibrant. And this one is called a smoked star anise because the farmers, these two Vietnamese sisters, that grow this spice, process it and dry it on their own farm. And it does have a nice smoky flavor to it, which is just lovely.
I want to mention that I generally don't like smoky thing. When they say smoky things, they it's burnt. But this, somehow the smoke, or if they put this over a fire somehow, it has made it aromatic to the point of, boy, that's really fun, Donna. That's really fun. So smoked star anise, how good.
The other thing that I recently bought, people forget to use this. You know, we all use bay leaves a lot. Just throw a few in the pot. Every time I make a stock, I throw in a handful of bay leaves and things like that. But ground bay is, smell this, Lana.
Ooh, that's like strong.
That's very nice, ooh, isn't it? This is the laurel bay leaf ground, and this is a Turkish bay leaf. I have been known to, the thing is when you grind the bay leaves yourself to get them in, and I use a coffee grinder to grind my spices, or an electric spice grinder. You have to do quite a bit of the bay spice to get the leaves to grind. So I thought, okay, I'm just going to haul off and buy this. Let me tell you my favorite use for this.
Uh-huh.
Liver and onions.
Now, wouldn't
just
that be
use
good?
Salt and pepper and a fair amount of this on the liver before you pan fry it. And it is delicious.
Now that would be really good. Although I use bay leaves in things, but I thought, well, if you ground it up like a lot of other spices, all the volatile oils leave.
Well, you want to use it fairly quickly. And the beauty of having it in the powder form, of course you can drop a pinch of it into the soup pot and things like that, but you can also then include it in, like, if you're going to make a turkey rub or because it's in a powder, it can go into a rub blend, which is really nicely. Now, the other thing that we haven't talked about are peppers. Okay. There's, of course, all kinds of black peppers. I tend to use the Tillicherry standard classic black pepper, and I do grind it myself. I use a pepper mill, or if I'm doing a lot of cooking, I will just freshly grind some and have it in a little dish so I can use it really quickly. The other one I love are pink peppercorns, which are not traditionally actually in the, it's a small flower from a something called a pepper tree, but it is not technically a peppercorn.
Oh, really? I just thought they made it just because it's pretty. That's
no, it has a nice, almost citrusy little spicy scent to it. But in, I cook, it's like salt and pepper. You always put some in, right? But those are things that people vary widely in how much salt they want, how much pepper they want. And those are things, the heat and the salt can always be added at the table. So when I'm cooking for a group of people, unless it's somebody that I know that really loves spicy food, I will use fairly mild peppers for my pepper flavor. Now, there's the black pepper flavor, and then there's the chili pepper flavor.
There is
Burlap and Barrel has on its website a very nice diagram that shows the heat levels of peppers. So I have several, I've gotten out several kinds of peppers that I really like to use a lot. There's one now that used to be called Aleppo pepper. Of course, we no longer have Aleppo. That is a very sad story.
Oh, so Aleppo as in Syria.
Yeah, it was a Syrian pepper. And forever it was called Aleppo pepper. It is now referred to as silk chili, formerly Aleppo pepper and things like that. And it's grown mostly in Turkey. I use it because it gives you that, almost like, you know how a bell pepper gives you a pepper flavor without the heat? Mm-hmm. This is a little more heat than that, but it is a lovely, not very hot. And its cousin is also something from Turkey called the Urfa pepper.
Oh, yes. That's the one that for the longest time I thought it was Ufta. It's not Ufta.
No, it's
folks.
Not Ufta. It's
Urfa.
Urfa.
U-R-F-A.
Now, this one is not really smoky. Is that smoky to you?
No, it almost tastes fruity.
Yeah,
fruity.
That's what you're wanting from these peppers.
And the ground mm-hmm. pepper looks really kind of oily and
well, because these two are both packed with a little bit of oil to keep them holding their flavor in a certain way. So the Urfa pepper is like very dark, almost black, whereas the silk chili is red, and they are very close relatives, but they're processed differently, giving them a different flavor. In the sort of another one that I use a lot that isn't very hot is ancho. If you're making a tortilla soup that's red, it's usually red because of the ancho chilies, not because of tomatoes necessarily. And ancho has a really full chili flavor without the heat. It's one of the things that you can easily use in Mexican and Central American foods where you don't want to make it so hot that people can't deal with it. Another one. Okay, then you get to the paprikas.
Okay, question. Paprikas, yes. I didn't know if paprika is a certain kind of pepper. Or is it just processed and called paprika? Does that mean ground pepper? So what did you find out about paprika?
Well, as far as I can tell, of course, the paprika name is derived of Hungarian chilies, basically. And there's sweet paprika and there's smoked paprika. So this is a new one that I got from Burlap and Barrel.
Let me find something for one of the tastes on.
Okay. This is the, they call this one the noble sweet paprika,
and it's so pretty.
And it is
very red
from Hungary, and it's really, it does have a nice full strong you know, lots of times, you know, if you get those deviled eggs and you at a party or somewhere, the paprika is sprinkled on for color, mm-hmm. but it really is flavorful if you have a good paprika that's not too old, because of course it's ground. Which means it's not going to hold its flavor forever.
Mm-hmm. That's paprika is something that can die a early death in a lot of spice racks in your home kitchen because you buy it because of course you need it for the deviled eggs and then it sits there and after a while you have nice red dust but it's not paprika.
Yeah. I would say use it up and enjoy it while it's still full of flavor. Now the other thing, let's see. This is a new thing also from Burlap and Barrel. It's called the Jimmy Nardello Pepper. What do you think of this one, Lana? It's a sweet pepper.
Jimmy Nardello peppers?
We can grow them here, right?
They made quite a to-do about, 20 years ago or so when the heirloom varieties were coming online and people were getting really excited about growing heirloom things. Jimmy Nardello peppers work really well.
It's
here.
A long, skinny, sweet. Long skinny. It's an Italian variety. So it's once the growing season is over and you've missed your Jimmy Nardello peppers, just go for the dried flakes. They're really lovely. And they do give that pepper, sweet pepper flavor that you want without the heat. So there are plenty of options. Okay, I'm going to mention one last thing. This is something I've just been trying. It's from another company that I like to order from online called Rancho Gordo, which is a California. They are known for their heirloom beans. That's mostly what I order from them and Pasoli and things. But I was ordering beans, so I thought, oh, here's a new product. It's called Stardust Chili Dipping Powder for fruit and more. And it,
chili dipping powder.
Yeah, it's not too hot. It has dried chilies and the crystallized lime, which is close to that black lime powder, and lime juice and citric acid and salt and a Mexican oregano. Ooh. And Lana and I have been oven drying or making our tomato candy like crazy. So, I've just been taking a nice corn tortilla, plopping some of those freshly out of the oven roasted tomatoes and sprinkling a little of this Rancho Gordo Stardust on it and chomping down. It's like a great, no cheese, no nothing.
See, there's so much good stuff you can eat out there. We're celebrating herbs and spices from the pantry here today. This is KHOI and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Find out more at www.khoifm.org. We are back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We've been talking about herbs and spices from the pantry. And actually, we have a good time doing that. Like I said, when someone comes up to you and says, here, taste this. Do. Because it's part of a good way to connect up with the world. It is. Oh, one thing that Donna's been giving me things to taste all day, and I'm kind of stuck on a lot of them, but I've been enjoying all of them. I've been growing a thing in my garden called Cuban oregano.
Oh, my turn to taste.
Yeah, you taste that. I dried it, and it's this funny little sort of succulent looking.
Does it look like an oregano?
It looks like a fat oregano. It big, kind of little teeny tiny leaves. They got little round.
Oh, I just crushed the leaf in my hand. It smells wonderful.
Let's see. And I must say that when I grew it in the garden, it's a really nice house plant too. So, and then But I don't really like it fresh. It kind of reminds me of dirty socks, you know. Like
it's a really strong oregano.
Yeah, it's a really strong oregano.
You know, there are dishes, and this is what you use, because there's the Italian oreganos and the Mexican oreganos, mm-hmm. and they are slightly different. Mm-hmm. And I usually just stick with, you know, if I'm making Mexican food, I will use Mexican oregano, and Italian food, and you use Italian oregano. Of course, you can change that up, whatever you want. This is a strong oregano.
It is. It's very
you could overdo it.
Yes.
But for
yes.
certain things, it's probably really nice. It hits those oregano. There's that kind of bitterness that's always mm-hmm. in oregano. It's mm-hmm. not like sweet basil. You know, you want that little oomph to it.
Right. I looked up on the internet to find, what is this with Cuban oregano? And I actually just bought it as a houseplant because it was kind of a pretty little plant, little round leaves, kind of succulent looking, and it does well over the winter. I put it outside in the summer, did fine there too, but the smell of it and the taste of it, like I said, was too strong. So I tried a little bit of it, and I'll probably use it again. I looked it up, and yes, it is grown in Cuba, Cuban oregano. And however, the Cubans call it French oregano. So get that.
Go figure.
Well, whenever you get something foreign, you call it something else. You call it the Asian flu or French fries. You know, we call things different things, but this kind of interesting plant. And,
I think maybe I should do a last load of, oven roasted tomatoes with some of this on it. A small amount.
Yeah. I think it would go very well with that. Yes. So you have got a great collection of good things to try. And
I think cooking, you know, if somebody asks me my best trick about cooking, I always say it's going deep on the flavors. Like if I read a recipe, I will almost automatically put more of, like, if it's cinnamon. There's some spices you can overdo and herbs, like too much rosemary is not any fun. I would say maybe too much Cuban oregano might not be any fun either. But generally, more of the herbs and seasonings than a recipe would normally call for. I just like get more flavor in there. Go deeper.
My thoughts exactly. More is better. Have fun out there. As we come to the end of this Donna Lana Kitchen, there's other things going on. Donna mentioned roasted tomatoes. And I've been growing tomatoes for quite a while, and I like to save my seeds just because of the sport of it all. Yes, I can go through seed catalogs, and I do. I order all kinds of new kinds of seeds each year.
I want to remind you all that Lana grows 30 varieties of tomatoes every summer.
And that's just because it's really fun. It's not everybody's cup of tea, or should I say cup of tomato, but I enjoy that. And I ended up with all these great different tomato varieties. But then quite a few years ago, I learned how to save tomato seeds. And just think about it. These fruit, or actually, yeah, tomatoes are technically
they're fruit.
That's why they grow the fruit, because they are growing seeds for next year's plants. They already know how to do this. If you open up a tomato, you see the little seeds on the inside of it. And now you can, and traditionally you can just do this, squash the tomato seeds out and put it on a paper or newspaper or something and let it dry. And then you pick out the seeds after it dries. Because the idea is, if you want to save these seeds over the winter, they cannot be damp, okay? They have to be dry and out of the light to last over the winter. Traditionally, a tomato would fall on the ground, then maybe get eaten by something and deposited otherwheres, or the way it just fell on the ground and covered up a little bit. And so there's catch as catch can, but tomatoes do just self-seed out there too if you let them. But if you want to save seed, you can do that. Now, like I said, traditionally you just let them a glop of tomato stuff, just let it dry on a piece of paper. However, that goo that is around the tomato seeds, the gelatinous substance that is actually there to protect the tomato seeds and to feed it and to keep it healthy, that is really hard to dry. And so somewhere between drying that and getting dry seeds, sometimes it just doesn't work too well. If you can get rid of the goo, get rid of the gelatinous material, you'll be a lot better off. And I found a great way to do this. I found this method from Seed Savers Exchange. You can Google any, there's lots of people that know how to do this. Saving tomato seeds from Seed Savers Exchange is where I learned. But what this is the fermentation process. Talk about fermentation. We're using
so that's good for the seeds.
Well, this little seed seem to thrive, because just think of how what naturally happens. Something falls on the ground,
right.
It's going to ferment
rot,
eventually,
right?
Okay. So if we can mindfully ferment those seeds for a little while, really truly, it breaks down the sticky, gooey gelatinous material that is around the seeds. And if you ferment it for a while, just a few steps, and then you can save seeds dry and in well-labeled and in a place to start. So my method is, and again, you can Google this because it's kind of
on Seed Savers website, right?
Yeah, Seed Savers website. And I just Googled saving tomato seeds, Seed Savers, and I got this up because I've been doing this for years. I take a tomato, turn it with the bottom side toward me in my hand, and I make an X on the bottom. If you think about what a tomato is on the inside, it's got these little pockets of tomatoes, pockets of seeds and gelatinous goo in there. And then over a bowl, I turn that tomato over and squash it till all of the gooey stuff, and you'll get some pulp.
So you're just squeezing it in your hand and dribbling it into the bowl. Yeah.
And you'll see these little seeds squish out, and there it is. And if you want to select a good tomato, and if you're real smart about it, you keep track of what tomato variety it is, you know. You don't have to. The tomatoes know what they're called. They don't need a name. But if you want to keep track of that, you put that in a bowl. I use little yogurt containers. And then, after you've squished it, you let it ferment. Believe it or not, and I have a little jar here that's been fermenting for
about... It just ferments in its own juice, or do you add water?
Ferment it. And now, Seed Savers says as water. I don't. There's plenty of water there. I let it ferment until there is mold on the top. Really, truly, listeners, there's mold on the top. About 4 or 5 days. Each tomato is a little different. But then, after it's been fermenting on your counter...
So at room temperature.
At room temperature. The viable seeds will fall to the bottom. The fermented icky bits will be on the top. Then I get a fine sieve, hold it over the sink, dump the tomato seed glop in there, the fermented glop, and rinse it well with not hot water, but warm water. And all of that...
Oh, so the rinsing takes all the fuzzy
all the fuzzy
off.
Icky bits out. Then you end up with sieve full of seeds. I turn that over on a plate. Just go bonk on a plate. The seeds kind of end up in a pile, or I push them apart a little bit so the air can get to them. Now, Seed Savers says put them on a paper plate, but that just sticks them to the paper plate. I put them on a regular china plate from the kitchen, and then I let it on the counter for 4 or 5 days.
Just air dry.
On the weather. Air dry, uh-huh. Air dry. And then you can break them apart, and you have dry seeds. Wait till they're dry. Break them apart and make sure they're dry, and label them.
You store them in an envelope then?
I make little, now you can buy seed packets or seed envelopes if you want to, mm-hmm. but all I do is take some wax paper, cut off, make a little square and fold it up like a little envelope and put the seeds in there, and then slide that wax paper into an envelope,
And write the name on it.
And write the name on it. And do put the year on it, folks, because you will forget it. And then put it in a dry and cool place, a nice drawer someplace in the back. And
where you won't forget about it.
Where you won't forget. Kind of where, you know, where your garden-y things are. You probably have some other seeds you've saved. So, like I said, if you want to find out more about saving tomato seeds, you can Google just saving tomato seeds. But the Seed Savers Exchange website has a really nice tutorial about the whole thing. One thing I want to say about that, their tutorial has got things happening. They use small jelly jars as their fermenting containers, which is fine. It's a great place to ferment things. However, when I'm squashing seeds, my tomato juice goes all over the place. So I use a bigger bowl to start out with. And don't worry, you will get a drop of tomato and maybe even a tomato seed or two squish up in your face. You will learn which way to cut the tomato seed. If you cut the bottom and squish that way, it's fine. If you cut the side of the tomato, it will come right out and hit you in the face, which is probably only fair. If you want to look up something, look up the Great Molasses Flood of 1919. This is, I got this from Wikipedia, but I heard about this first from Ben. January 15th, 1919, in Boston, Massachusetts.
Cold, yes.
So it was cold, and they were, along the shoreline there was a big factory that was dealing in a huge bunch of molasses, and they don't quite know what happened. The cause of this disaster was called cylinder stress. Anyway, this big, big vat of molasses burst, and they think it's because they added hot molasses to the cold molasses that was in there. Anyway, a large storage tank filled with 2.3 million gallons of molasses, weighing approximately 13 tons, my goodness, burst, and the resultant wave of molasses rushed through the streets of Boston at an estimated, now this is molasses, you know, as slow as molasses, but listen to this, estimated 35 miles an hour, killing 21 people,
whoa,
injuring at 150, and it's part of Boston. History, who would have thought? And people died by drowning in molasses, and it started to congeal, around horses, and other people like got stuck. Okay. So this wave was at one point 25 feet high. They could measure it on the buildings, and it moved about 35 miles an hour.
Goodness, that's rather.
And so anyway, waist deep, covered the streets. It was nasty. And if you want to clean up something not so good, let's try some molasses. They say Boston smelled kind of sweet and sticky. We've been talking about herbs and spices today. There's so many fun things to try. Thanks to Ben Hawks for joining us today. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find us here Tuesday at noon, repeated at 7 p.m., or anytime at the KHOI website. Music today by the Barn Owl Band. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We'd have excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.